From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is VOA Senior Political Analyst Brian Padden. Our topic on this edition of the program, the primary process in U.S. presidential elections. Our guest, one of the foremost experts on how America nominates its presidential candidates, Elaine Kmark. Kmark specializes in American electoral politics and government innovation and reform in the United States and abroad. She's founding director of the Center for Effective Public Management and senior fellow in the Governance Studies Program at the Brookings Institution. That's a prominent policy group here in Washington. Elaine Kmark's book, Primary Politics, Everything You Need to Know About How America Nominates Its Presidential Candidates, is one of the most highly regarded primers on U.S. primaries. She has been a member of the Democratic National Committee, where she serves on the Rules Committee, since 1997 and has served as a so-called superdelegate to five Democratic conventions. Elaine Kmark has participated actively in four presidential campaigns and 10 nominating conventions, including two Republican conventions. Elaine is one of the founders of the New Democrat Movement, which helped to elect President Bill Clinton, in whose administration she served as senior policy advisor to Vice President Al Gore. As an academic, her research focuses on 21st century government, the role of internet in political campaigns, homeland defense, intelligence reorganization, and governmental reform and innovation. And Elaine Kmark joins us here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Elaine, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
And I'm delighted to welcome my colleague, Brian Padden.
Thank you.
Well, Elaine, first I'd like to get your observations of the Democratic primary process. We're witnessing, of course, President Trump is not facing any viable Republican opposition, so we're following the Democrats. After Tuesday's primaries in Michigan, Missouri, Mississippi, North Dakota, Idaho, and Washington State, it seems like the momentum and math favors former Vice President Joe Biden. And some analysts were saying if Bernie Sanders didn't win Michigan, that would not be a good sign for him going forward. I'd like to get your view of where the Democratic primary process stands at this point.
I think the first thing our listeners need to remember is that the U.S. primary system is a sequential system. So what matters a lot is the sequence of the contests. And each contest then builds on the subsequent contest. So what we're seeing now is what we see almost always in the modern nominating system, which is a winnowing out of the field. We started with an enormous field in January. We got rid of some people early on who dropped out of their own volition. Iowa further shrunk the field, as did New Hampshire and Nevada. And now we are down to a two-person race. In that race, it looks like Joe Biden is building a significant lead. He has had wins in states that were surprising. He won in Michigan, and 4 years ago, Bernie Sanders won in Michigan. Not only did Biden win in Michigan, but he won every demographic. He won the big cities where there's lots of African Americans. He won the white, wealthier suburbs, and he won the white working class towns filled with auto workers. So he really has been sweeping across the board. And that's why people think that he has got a significant chance to beat Bernie Sanders in the nomination race.
We'll get more about the Democratic primaries, but let me go back and ask you about the role of primaries in the United States. You said in a recent article, America's political parties have relinquished their role in choosing presidential candidates to a degree unheard of in other major democracies. Can you help us understand this rather esoteric U.S. primary process?
Until 1972, the process for nominating the Democratic and the Republican candidates for president was similar to that you would find in another democracy. In other words, it was an internal party process where in parliamentary democracies, for instance, the party will have its conferences. They will select a party leader. The party leader basically then becomes the head of state. And so for more than than 100 years in the United States, from 1831 all the way till 1972, we had party conventions composed of party notables, party office holders, elected officials, and they chose the presidential candidates. So it was an internal system. That didn't mean that it didn't change, because various people could take over the party at the grassroots level, but it was more similar to other democracies. Beginning in 1972, and as a result of a reform movement that came about after the conflict in the Democratic Party over the Vietnam War, we started to have what are called binding primaries. So as we saw in 2016 in the Republican Party, even though a lot of Republican leaders at the time did not want Trump to be their nominee, in fact, went so far as not going to the Cleveland Convention, the fact of the matter was that they really couldn't do much about it, because the primaries were electing delegates who were bound to Trump. So similarly, now we have a process where the primary voters are the ones that matter, and the elected officials and the party leaders have very little power to determine who the nominee will be.
When we're talking about this year's process, and we saw this incredibly sharp coalescing around Biden following or before Super Tuesday, where a number of states voted, those moderates dropping out of the race, putting their support behind Joe Biden, seemed to kind of give him momentum through which he is now gaining a clear majority. Can you contrast that process this year with what happened with the Republicans in 2016, where President Trump, who was able to divide a number of different moderate or conservative Republicans in those races, but they did not drop out, and therefore President Trump was able to keep gaining the majority of delegates? And there's, I guess, different processes for Republicans and Democrats, where Republicans sometimes take all the delegates who win the most in the state. Can you kind of make sense of all this for us?
You know, what happened with Trump's nomination in 2016 are two things. First of all the other candidates practically stayed in race after race after race. Even when they were losing, they stayed in. And the anti-Trump forces never coalesced around an alternative, nor did the voters. Secondly, is that the Democrats use proportional representation to award delegates. The Republicans have a variety of systems, but they are more winner-take-all, which meant that with a plurality of votes, Trump was winning all of the delegates. And that helped him, not by this time necessarily, but by the end of March in 2016, Trump had a substantial delegate lead, and it just kept growing. But the fundamentals were that the absence of a clear alternative to Trump allowed him to win the Republican nomination, even though at the time, lots of Republicans were against him, and everybody thought he would lose the presidential election.
And do you think then the Democrats this year were looking back and trying to learn from what happened?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the Democrats were quite cognizant of the fact that if they stayed in for whatever reasons, primary after primary after primary, they were going to be taking votes away from the person who was most likely to beat Sanders and, frankly, most likely to beat Donald Trump. And that was, I think, a very important consideration in the minds of the candidates as they dropped out. And I think it's been an important consideration, and we know a little bit of this from exit polls, in the minds of the voters themselves.
You referenced earlier the sequencing of primaries. Many people now are talking within the Democratic Party about seeing how that could change. We start with the Iowa caucuses in New Hampshire. These are states that they're not very representative of the Democratic demographic, and they're saying that it skews things. And how do you see it? And why are those states go first? Could that be modified? What would it take to modify that? Would that be for the better?
Well, the National Party has the authority to set the calendar. The Republicans and the Democrats have agreed on a calendar for over a decade now. This has been an unusual point of cooperation between the two parties. I think what is likely to happen in the future is not so much that we will change the order of the states, but that we will not have first-in-the-nation caucuses. caucuses are much, much smaller in terms of participation than our primaries because you don't just pick up the kids from soccer practice and go vote. You have to actually have several hours on a Monday night to go and participate in the caucus. And because of that, they really exclude a lot of people. And so my prediction, such as it is that in the future, we will not have a first-in-the-nation caucus. That would affect Iowa and Nevada. Which primaries are first? I would have to anticipate that New Hampshire would still be first. They've hung on for more than a century. I suspect they'll stay in there. And I would also anticipate that South Carolina would remain early because of the large black population on the Democratic side, but also on the Republican side. Republicans like the South Carolina primary. They have always seen it as a place where staunch conservatives can undo whatever nonsense happens in the northern states. So you have both parties with a fondness for South Carolina being an early primary, albeit for different reasons.
That seems odd in the sense that South Carolina is not a state that ever seems to be in play. It's always a Republican state. It always has a large African-American population. But a Democrat who wins South Carolina does it with a lot of African-American support. And so the person kind of reinforces his or her connection with that community. But he or she, the Democratic candidate, does not win South Carolina. So in your estimate, which state actually could give us kind of the best first state insight into who would be most electable?
Well, here you run up against another issue, is the consensus has been for a long time that there is some value in having small states go first. So really representative states, well, Illinois is probably the most representative state in the United States. It's a very big state with a very big city in it, but farmers and every manufacturing and everything. But the countervailing value here is that people like the idea that presidential candidates have to campaign in a state where they can actually campaign with real live voters. After you get out of these early states, the campaigns are all in radio studios and TV studios. The actual pressing of the flesh is few and far between. You just can't campaign in California by shaking enough hands. It's physically impossible. And so if you're going to have an early state, you look for a small state.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. Our guest is Elaine Kmark. She's founding director of the Center for Effective Public Management and senior fellow in the Governance Studies program at the Brookings Institution. She's author of the widely esteemed book, Primary Politics, Everything You Need to Know About How America Nominates Its Presidential Candidates. I'm Carol Castiel, along with VOA senior political analyst Brian Padden. This is a reminder that our Press Conference USA podcast is available for free download on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA. Here's a shout out to one of our most loyal listeners, Chidi Goodness. He's a Nigerian residing in London. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to our special guest, Elaine Kmark, talking about the Democratic primaries. The word delegate is very important. Elaine, what is the role of the delegates in our primary process?
Well, the delegates are kind of a holdover from an earlier era when party conventions nominated the presidential candidates. So in ordinary races in the modern era that are settled in the primary and everyone drops out and everyone goes to the convention pledged to one candidate, the delegate's role is to hold up those signs and wear funny hats and cheer for the candidate and boo the other party. That's what the delegates do. What is lost in that is that the delegates still do have the final authority in determining the nomination. The nomination of a political party is not a fully public activity. It is a party activity. And so if for some reason the primaries did not deliver a clean verdict, then those delegates would actually have to decide who they were going to be for. On the first ballot, they were most likely to be for the candidate that elected them. But if, for instance, it was a three-way split and no one got a majority on the first ballot, then those delegates would be released, and who knows who would become the candidate. In the old days, we often had multi-ballot conventions as the coalitions within the party sorted themselves out. We're not used to that these days. We haven't seen a multi-ballot convention since 1952. So there's a lot that we don't know about how that would work in the modern day and age. But that would still happen, and delegates would still be important if, in fact, you went beyond a first ballot.
Well, that leads me to ask you about the delegates for the candidates that threw their support behind Joe Biden, for example, Pete Buttigieg and Amy Klobuchar and even Michael Bloomberg. What happens to their delegate count?
Well, first of all, one weird thing to understand is at this point in time, there are simply delegate allocations. There are very few real live people in those slots. Most of these people get elected in April or May. To the extent that people are elected in April or May, those people are essentially free agents. They can do whatever they want to do. They don't have to follow their candidate. Amy Klobuchar delegate doesn't have to vote for Joe Biden, although you could pretty much assume that they would, given the similarity between the two candidates. And they are free agents in the nomination process.
And they are elected at state conventions in April?
Some are elected at congressional district conventions. Some are elected at state conventions. And most of those start to take place in the spring, in April and May. By the second week in June, the states have to have finished electing the actual people, and they will be certified to the national party, and then credentials will be given out to those people.
Is that similar for Republicans? They have the similar process?
Very much the same.
Can I ask you about the Michael Bloomberg experience in the primaries? He was late coming in. He flooded the campaign airwaves with his vast fortune, spending hundreds of millions of dollars on ads, hiring campaign staff in many states, and then showed very poorly for all the money he spent. What's the lesson there?
Well, the lesson there is that money can't buy politics, at least at the presidential level. Maybe at other levels it can, but certainly not at the presidency, because people have a very personal relationship to the president. And I think that Michael Bloomberg, when he was out on his own, not packaged with all his money, had a disastrous first debate. People didn't like him. He didn't seem comfortable. He didn't seem warm. He didn't even seem to really be part of the party that was on stage. There was one very awkward moment where he searched for a word to refer to the other people on the stage, and he said, "Well, my fellow contestants, I guess we'll call them." Now, anybody else would have said, "My fellow Democrats." So it was kind of an indication of what a flop that was. I also think that advertising, particularly blanketing advertising like he did and Tom Steyer, the other billionaire in the race, did, I think voters discount that. Americans are very, very cynical about advertisements. I mean, we don't go out and buy the car that has the prettiest blonde standing next to the car. I mean, we're very sophisticated consumers, and we're very skeptical about ads. And I think political ads fall in that category, just as ads about washing machines or cars do.
Well, they may be sophisticated about ads and even cynical, but I wouldn't say that's the case vis-a-vis the internet and all kinds of disinformation that we are seeing. I have seen very intelligent people somehow fall for the disinformation, whether it's through the Russians or other Americans that are influenced by Russians, pushing disinformation, whether about Mr. Biden or other Democratic candidates in particular. They seem to be the targets. So how do you see that as an obstacle or a challenge as we approach the 2020 elections?
I think it's a huge challenge, but I also have a little bit more faith in the American people. It's like any weapon. In war, what do we know from time immemorial? The first person to have the new weapon, that's the winner. And then by the next time you fight a war, everybody has those guns, or everybody has those bow and arrows, or everybody has airplanes or whatever. Well, it's sort of the same thing here. In 2016, nobody saw this coming. Nobody knew what it was. Nobody understood what it was. It wasn't until we had the Mueller indictments that we saw the extensive nature of the Russian interference. I think that with every successive election, people will get a little bit more skeptical about what they're hearing, particularly if it seems outrageous. And I think that we'll see that happening. We saw a little bit of what looks like Russian interference in this primary campaign so far. It's no secret that their two candidates have been Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders. So we saw a little bit of that this time. But I'm sort of curious to see if next time around it goes unanswered. Part of it, of course, was Hillary's campaign was slow to understand what was happening. This ridiculous notion of Pizzagate, this ridiculous message manufactured by the Russians, they thought it was so ridiculous that why on earth should you talk about it? Pizzagate was the allegation that there was, this is so bizarre, it kind of makes me laugh just to say it. The story was that there was a pizza parlor in Washington, D.C., and that in the basement of the pizza parlor, Hillary Clinton and her friends were running a pedophile ring. Now, none of us may have even known about that, except that there was some poor sod in South Carolina, North Carolina, who actually believed it and came to Washington with a gun ready to free the children who were in this basement under the pizza parlor. And of course, he was arrested and there were no children there, et cetera, et cetera. And he's actually since apologized. So that was kind of bubbling out there, but nobody thought it was serious enough to answer it.
Well, I hope you're right, Elaine, in being cautiously optimistic, but I'm seeing this type of disinformation and brainwashing infiltrate, even among many Republicans. I'm not picking on them per se, but it seems that they're more susceptible to this kind of disinformation, promoting the propaganda of the Kremlin that somehow it was Ukraine that interfered in the 2016 election, not the Russians. We saw that during the impeachment trial, mouthing the kinds of theories that are propaganda that have been debunked.
Yes.
They're going mainstream. This is what concerns me.
Well, and it should, but remember what's really causing that to have some legs, as we say, is the fact that the president of the United States believes it and propagates it. If the president had not been doing that, then it might be a little bit easier to discount as Russian propaganda. But when the president picks it up and some of his allies in Congress pick it up, then it's a very serious situation.
And we're seeing that more and more
as
Mr. Biden becomes the formidable front runner, somebody that he's afraid of running against. And in fact, that was the reason he was impeached, because he tried to collect dirt on Mr. Biden through a foreign country, an ally. And we know what happened after that.
That's right.
This year, in the midst of the primary season, the coronavirus worldwide pandemic has been spreading, impacting some campaign events recently. Is this an unprecedented development, and are you concerned that it will have further impact on the conventions and the election itself?
Well, I think that we are able to have conventions and have an election even with the coronavirus. I mean, I think there's ways to do that. If need be, we could go to an electronic convention where we cast votes electronically, etc. That doesn't worry me as much. I think, however, it is having an enormous impact on the president, because to many people, the president is looking incompetent and out of his depth. And that is the sort of thing that can really undermine his support in the country. Up until this point, Donald Trump's presidency has been free of the kind of crises that impact average Americans. He's had various crises overseas, et cetera, but nothing that really hits home with Americans. And I think a lot of Americans have liked his flamboyant style and his just the way he likes to stick it to people. I think that's been, you know, a lot of people thought that was fun. All of a sudden, we're faced with a very different sort of situation where reality matters and leadership matters. And so far, Donald Trump is not doing very very well at all.
Elaine, back to this whole primary process about which you've written so extensively. Do you have any suggestions for enacting primary election reform? What are the biggest challenges to enacting this type of reform? And again, what suggestions do you have to improve our current process?
Well, I think that the biggest problem with the current process is that there is no peer review in the process. Peer review is common in all advanced societies. When you go to a neurosurgeon, you want that neurosurgeon to have been certified by other neurosurgeons. You don't want your neurosurgeon having won a popularity contest. So peer review is a very common element. In the old system and in democracies where you still have an internal party process, you have some element of peer review because you have people who are politicians who are in government or have been in government, they know the individuals and they know the sorts of things that you can't tell over the television or in a primary. Is this person serious? Are they substantive? Are they able to grasp the big ideas and all the complexities that they would be faced with as president? And we got rid of that when we went to primaries. Primary voters, and it's not because they're dumb, it's just that primary voters simply can't make that assessment because they don't see the candidates up close and personal, other than in a couple instances in those early states. And even then, they're not seeing the candidates in a governing mode. So what I would do is keep all the primaries as is, but insert some element of peer review, maybe a simple vote of confidence by the House of Representatives, by the people of your own party in the House or in the Senate or among the governors or among the National Committee people, something that would keep our debate stages from being crowded with people who have no business running for president of the United States and simply take up airtime from more serious candidates.
Isn't what the Democratic Party did in installing superdelegates, wasn't that kind of a way to put some party oversight into the process so that an extreme candidate would have to overcome that hurdle to get the nomination?
The Democratic Party has superdelegates. They are all Democratic members of Congress, all Democratic members of the Senate, all Democratic governors, all members of the Democratic National Committee, and that's what I am. I'm a member of the Democratic National Committee. And then a handful of other people like former presidents of the United States. So President Clinton and President Jimmy Carter obviously get votes at the convention. The superdelegates were intended to do just that. The problem with the superdelegates is they do not have a formal role at the beginning of the process. And that's what I'm suggesting, is that we force them to say something. They don't have to say, I like this person over this person. They simply need to say, these people I think are capable of being president and these people are not. The other reason to insert some element of peer review is to reduce the number of absurd policy statements that get made that everybody who's had some experience in government knows are just ridiculous. The big one being, I'm going to build a wall and make Mexico pay for it. How on earth was Donald Trump ever going to make Mexico pay for a wall short of an all-out invasion of the country? I mean, it's just a stupid statement. Everybody knew that, but it was a great line in his rallies. And so I think that a little bit of reality injected into the policy positions of some of these candidates would be a big help to the voters.
And as we close, Elaine, any thoughts with respect to bringing the Democratic Party together? Let's assume Joe Biden achieves an insurmountable number of delegates and becomes the nominee. Do you see Bernie Sanders getting behind Mr. Biden and also bringing his more youthful followers to the side of Mr. Biden?
I think if anybody could do that, it is Joe Biden. Joe Biden is not a perfect candidate. He stumbles around in his words sometimes, okay? Sometimes he's not as energetic as you would have him be. He's got a long, long history, which some people pick apart. But the one thing that has kept Joe Biden front and center in Washington for almost four decades now is he is one of the nicest men in Washington. People love Joe Biden. And you can see that in some of the body language on the debate stage. He's nice to Bernie, and Bernie is nice to him. Bernie says things like, Joe Biden is my friend. Put it this way, there's nothing guaranteed, but I think if anybody can do it, it is Joe Biden.
Elaine Kmark is Senior Fellow in the Governance Studies Program at the Brookings Institution and author of the acclaimed book, Primary Politics, Everything You Need to Know About How America Nominates Its Presidential Candidates. Elaine, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks so much for having me, both of you.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Kim Lewis for booking our guest. Our engineer was Vasco Volorich. And joining me on the program was VOA senior political analyst Brian Padden. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.